Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, October 26, 2015. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, an interview I did with Bobby Kennedy for Ring of Fire Radio. It's a fascinating interview, and I thought I would share it on this program. It's not too long. We've got plenty of other things to talk about as well. The Republican debate, the third Republican debate, or the fifth and sixth, depending on how you count them, is just now, well, we should have a countdown clock, right? It would be 58 hours until that moment that we can't wait for, because that's why you have a countdown clock. It's because you can't wait for something to happen. And then when the hours pass, it comes there. So, for instance, if I was to say I had a clock on my desk that's counting down how much time I have left as governor of Florida, I would either be saying, A, I can't wait to not be governor of Florida anymore, or B, in telling you that, I could also be telling, if you can read through the lines, I don't want to be president. It's just that my family, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of cool things I could be doing. I'm, of course, referencing Jeb Bush. We will get to that on the program today as well. Paul Ryan. He's so excited to become Speaker of the House. He's probably got a countdown clock until he is maybe elected on Wednesday. And then there's a countdown clock for the debt ceiling. For the highway bill? For other spending bills? It could just be a countdown clock until the Republicans shut down the government again. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders at the Jefferson Jackson speech, elbows getting a little sharper, wants to make those distinctions between him and Hillary Clinton. What did I say? The Jefferson Jackson dinner speech. Also on the program today, Marco Rubio, so sick of the Senate. And the chief law enforcement officer in the country. I guess not the chief, that would be the attorney general. I don't know where he ranks. But the head of the FBI has concluded, ladies and gentlemen, that the Black Lives Matter movement has contributed to the rise in violent crime in this country, and he does not have the statistics to back it up. In fact, he has no data to support his conclusion whatsoever. Doesn't make you feel so confident about how the FBI runs their investigations. We've got all that and more on the program today. I wanted to start off with some good news, though. From the Obama administration. And it really is a function of just how, I think, effective. Well, I mean, there has been a tremendous amount of agitating on this front. We've spoken about this on this program quite a bit. And it's obviously not just coming from the left, although this aspect of it, I think, in many respects is. We'll get to that in just a moment, this story about what's happening on the testing front. But ladies and gentlemen, as you know, I have recently made two hires in this office. In fact, you met them on Friday. Now, we're lucky on this program. Hey, Matt, you came to this program by hearing that Matt, the other Matt, was leaving. And, of course, you're also on that that bulletin board, that email thing, server for jobs for people with the name Matt, right? Is that?
Yeah, exactly. That's how I was able to get my resume in before that show was even finished.
Right. There you go. So you heard it on the Matt thing, but it was also through the show. And Kelly, actually, you two sort of like secondhand, right, from Dorsey, I think. Now, most people don't have a podcast or a platform where they can announce we're hiring and find people. So if you're hiring but want to find the best candidates, because you need good people, I can tell you that as a small business owner myself. But if you place your posting for your job in one place, it's not enough to find quality candidates. When you're short-staffed, there's no time to deal with dozens of different job sites until now, thanks to ZipRecruiter.com. I can post to 100-plus job sites with a single click and be instantly matched to candidates from over 6 million resumes. Michael, you shouldn't take that as a threat. I'm just telling you. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 400,000 businesses, and you can try it right now for free. And try it. You know, the best time to, honestly, I swear to God, the best time to sort of go through the motions of hiring somebody is when you don't need somebody. Frankly, we should have done that here because, well, you know, Matt gave me 2 weeks' notice, but that's not a lot of time. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Try ZipRecruiter now. Get your perfect candidate before they go to somebody else. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Again, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Try it out for free right now. All right, so let's get to this story about the Obama administration really backing off what has been education policy in this country for nearly two decades. According to the New York Times, faced with mounting and bipartisan opposition to increased and often high-stakes testing in the nation's public schools. And you know, from my perspective on this, I've been quite clear. I don't have an issue as much with the testing as I do the implications of the test, the stakes behind the testing. In the main, I think it's okay to test kids. I think it's good. I think it's necessary. I think it's necessary to assess where the kids are from the perspective of the teachers, from the perspective of the individuals. And I think that just, I think there is some value to kids getting a notion of like, look, I need to present the information I know in a way that is communicable to other people. However, the Obama administration declared Saturday that the push had gone too far. It acknowledged its own role in the proliferation of tests and urged schools to step back and make exams less onerous and more purposeful. The administration called for a cap on assessment so that no child would spend more than 2% of classroom instruction time taking tests. Now, this to me seems backwards again. The bottom line is you make the tests less relevant insofar as sort of the existential implications for people's jobs and for the functioning of schools. And then you will find that people are not, that teachers don't, it's not a rational decision as it is now to teach to the test. It called on Congress to, quote, reduce over-testing as it reauthorized the federal legislation governing the nation's public elementary and secondary schools. We've been talking about this legislation. We had Michael will tell me who the guest was, but I guess it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago. The administration's so-called testing action plan, which guides school districts but does not have the force of law, also risks creating a new uncertainty on the role of tests in America's schools. Indeed, many teachers have felt whiplash as they rush to rewrite curriculum based on new standards and new assessments, only to have politicians in many states pull back because of political pressure. It was Mercedes Schneider who came on the program, I think, and it spoke to us about that legislation. And this is coming on the heels, or I should say, in the wake of Arnie Duncan announcing his resignation as of December. The announcement came from Arnie Duncan, and it was backed by his designated successor, John B. King Jr. It's prompted in part by an anticipation of a new survey from the Council of Great City Schools, which set out to determine exactly how much testing is happening amongst its members. This is crazy. The survey, which was released on Saturday, found that students in the nation's big city schools will take on average about 112 mandatory standardized tests between pre-kindergarten and high school graduation. So that's 13 years. That's about 8 tests per year that are mandatory, that are standardized. And you know the implications of that, right? Because they're being used as a way of saying, like, this, we're going to give a death sentence to a school, or we're going to fire a teacher, or we're going to shut down, you know, half a dozen schools that service kids living in low-income areas. There was no evidence, the study found, that more time spent on tests improved academic performance, at least as measured by the National Assessment of Educational Progress. In other words, these tests are not being taken to help students. They're being taken to help, at best, the agendas of accountants. At worst, the agendas of people who want to actually destroy public education as an institution in this country. So this is long overdue. I have yet to see the details of this testing action plan, but I can only imagine that it doesn't quite get that dynamic. Because I don't understand how you put this in place if you genuinely care about expanding public education and making it effective for everyone. I don't understand, like, why you are fiddling around with testing as opposed to really looking at the real fundamental problem, which is the way that we fund schools in this country. I mean, all you need to do, I've been going around to middle schools, and I mentioned the other day that, I would be talking about this principal that I had met at one of the middle schools. I was, because in New York City, they have this thing called school choice. I have yet to sort of dig into how this policy was adopted for middle school. But basically, you're in a district, and there's, I don't know how many schools are in middle schools there are in this district, at least 10 or 15. And you got to go around and essentially apply, and you've got to rank what schools you want. And some schools will not look at you unless you rank them one or two. And you don't really have a sense as to whether or not your kid's going to get into that school. So then you get bumped down to three. And basically, this principal from Park Slope Collegiate is what it's called. And it's at a presentation. I'm getting a little off topic here, but bear with me. Went to a presentation the other night. Every one of these principals got up to sell their school. First thing she did is she put a overhead graphic showing the integration rates in this city over the past 30, 40 years. Apparently, the integration between white kids, and I think this may have just been for African Americans, white kids and black kids in this school system, the peak was 1988, around there. I'm just looking at the graphic from memory. And if you look at achievement in the white cohort and the black cohort, you can see that white cohorts, basically achievement was more or less steady. Some maybe upward growth. Black achievement was at least correlated to integration. I don't know if it was causal, but it was correlated. And a big part of that, I'm convinced, has to do with, you could really supplant socioeconomic status there too, I would imagine. In terms of just where you see poor schools, where you have kids coming in from middle income and upper income who have the opportunity to learn alongside kids from low income families. Because we've talked many times in the past about the learning deficit amongst low income kids. They enter into pre-K and kindergarten with a huge learning listening vocabulary deficit and speaking vocabulary deficit. They're just simply not as exposed to the same things as higher income kids are. They don't go to the circus, or they don't go to take that trip somewhere, which just necessarily makes the kids say, like, what's that? What's this? Or hear different words. And so we go around to these middle schools, and Park Slope Collegiate, it looks like the DOE has decided we're not going to put a dollar in this building. And we're not, we made that decision 40 years ago. And the teachers are great, the principal's great, but the place looks, I mean, there are like walls that are half built, not even half built, half falling apart. It's stunning. And I don't know, I don't know the history of why that is. I imagine under the Bloomberg administration, certain schools were just deemed like, we're just not going to put money there. And I know they wait around for that for money for the programs, but there's only, you know, the physicality of a building makes a big difference, I think, just from the kids learning. But so we'll see. I don't know if we'll ever get to that point where property taxes are not the number one funder of schools, because that makes it horribly skews things. And apparently in the city, it doesn't necessarily even work that way. Because this school is in the midst of a fairly wealthy neighborhood, as far as neighborhoods in Brooklyn go. It's, you know, close to South Slope. But we will see. And, of course, I've got like 14 other... I've got a tour tomorrow. I went to 4 different middle school functions last week. Yes. Homeschooling. That's, I think, what we're going to do. We're going to pull both of them out. We'll homeschool both of them. I don't care.
Good call.
Yeah. Now I know why people pay whatever it is, $80,000 a year to go to a private school, just so you can avoid this part.
But in some places, like I think in L.A., the private school process is just as stressful.
No, I think in New York, it's probably... All I heard was stories like where kids would go to... Where parents would go to... admissions counselors when their kids were in the womb for private school. So you get into a certain private school and that sort of takes you on some trajectory.
Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've told you before that I have been finding myself shaving more often than necessary. Part of that is you go to a middle school interview with the principal and you're trying to maybe kiss some ass, because part of it is they want to see that you're excited to go. Even if you're not the kid. So you shave to make it look like you're a little more respectable. Or maybe last week, for instance, I was on MSNBC twice in 1 week. Shaving can be a pain. It can be uncomfortable. Yes, causes razor burns all the time. Nicks. It happens to me as well. On top of that, it can be outrageously expensive. For about half the price of the other big branded blades, Harry's will ship the blades to your door. They're better too. The first blades were made in Germany and they liked them so much, Harry's just bought the entire factory there. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades? It's half the price at Harry's, and with Harry's, you get a better shave that respects your skin, face, legs. Like I said, I don't shave my legs anymore, but there was a time when I would do performances to show off my calf muscles, and I would shave my calves. That's right. It's true. No more poor quality blades. The starter set is an amazing deal. For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades. And if you use the promo code Majority Report, and it's your first time buying a Harry's razor, you can get $5 off that. That's $10 for a razor, shaving cream, and three razor blades. You got to do this once. They send it right to your door. It's so easy. It's unbelievable. Go to harrys.com now. Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in my coupon code Majority Report with your first purchase. That's harrys.com, spelled like Harry and then with an S because it's harrys.com. Enter the coupon code Majority Report at checkout for $5 off. Start shaving better today. All right. Let's play this interview. So that interview is really a conversation between Bobby Kennedy and I about his cousins, Patrick Kennedy, who, as you know, is a former congressman from Rhode Island. And Patrick suffered from, well, a couple of addictions. But he also talks about his father, Ted Kennedy. And there's a really, it's really fascinating. You know, I will just say this. I don't want to, you know, pre-tip the interview very much. But Patrick Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, you know, one of the things I think that, you know, sort of when we contemplate the Kennedy family, you just assume there's such myth around them. You just assume that they're just incredibly stoic. And I think they are. I mean, I think Ted Kennedy was incredibly stoic, and I think to his detriment. But contemplate the implications of having three of your brothers killed. The first brother was killed in World War II. And then your remaining two brothers assassinated one after each other. You never really contemplate what the implications are for a person when that happens. This is an interesting take. And, of course, you know, Patrick Kennedy is talking about this stuff in the context of trying to push for better understanding and better care from insurance companies, frankly, of things like addiction and whatnot. So here is that interview that I did on Ring of Fire with RFK. We'll play a little bit of music and then come back in from the music. It's in two parts, I believe, it's in one part. Okay. All right. Here's that interview. We'll be back in just a moment. Bobby Kennedy. So, Bobby, we have you by phone now, and your cousin, former Congressman Patrick Kennedy, he was on 60 Minutes to talk about his book, which has been released and in conjunction with a push that he's making to get some legislation passed in Washington. One of the things that I've noticed in the coverage of the book has been that supposedly Patrick's family, the Kennedys, are mad at Patrick because he has somehow crossed a boundary by talking about things that were supposed to be private within the family, supposedly. And I wanted to just get your reaction on that.
Well, there's 100 people in my family, Sam, so I think people are going to have different reactions to Patrick's book. I am personally really proud of Patrick. I think what he's doing is consistent with everything that my family stood for. He's fighting for an issue that he's passionate about, which is civil rights for people with mental illnesses. And he's trying to bring those people into America's democratic fold. He particularly wants to make sure that they feel confident to be out in the open and to be able to fight for their rights against an insurance industry that uses the secretiveness, the embarrassment, the shame, the stigma of mental illnesses to deny them compensation for their health care. In many cases, they are legally entitled to that compensation, but the insurers seldom pay it since they're confident that they can use the stigma to force people with mental illnesses to stand down. And Patrick is standing up for them. You know, Patrick recounts his personal journey in his book, and my family's known for its allergy toward talking about personal issues in public. it's not because of some code of omerta. It originated with the older generation, particularly with my grandmother, who just thought it was self-indulgent and tasteless for people to talk about their personal affairs. She used to always tell us, don't talk about yourselves, talk about your issues. And that ethic has been imbued in my family for generations. And it was regarded as, when I was growing up, as narcissistic to talk about your own personal problems. You can argue whether there's any merit in that approach or whether it's healthy or unhealthy or whatever, but that was part of our family ethic. And I think it was reinforced in my generation by the consciousness that our family stood for certain things and that those things were often unpopular, particularly at the power centers with the press and with powerful corporations and with the ideological right. And, you know, there's a large presence of right-wing ideology in the media that has a fierce antipathy toward my family and for all the things we stand for. And they know that gossip sells more papers and draws more eyeballs than serious discussion of issues. So gossip about my family fits both their political agenda and their financial agenda. So by attacking us personally or reporting lurid gossip, or our political opponents could discredit our issues and make money for themselves. So any piece of personal gossip, whether it was true or not, became fodder to discredit our issues and drive circulation and advertising revenues. So naturally, there was a guardedness in my generation. But having said that, that guardedness among my family, when we're out in the political world, doesn't extend to our relationships with friends and family. In private, I think there's a tremendous openness within our family and within our large army of close, trusted friends.
It seems to me that part of that silence about not speaking about issues within the family also sort of extended to some measure of a sense of responsibility, particularly when it came to Teddy dealing with the assassination of his brothers, your uncle and your father. I mean, it seems like there was a tremendous amount of pressure on him. And I imagine, and I guess this is what I'm asking you, if that extends to the family insofar as that we've got to put on a face for people, not just the rest of the family, but really, I mean, in many respects to the country, because, you know, your family have been seminal figures in the modern history of the United States.
Well, it's a combination of things. Teddy was, you know, utterly crushed by my father's assassination, and he'd already been devastated by the death of my Uncle Jack and his elder brother Joe and my grandfather's debilitating stroke. His three elder brothers had all died in the service of their country, and all of them died violently, and he was traumatized. Patrick's notion, you know, that he says that Teddy suffered post-traumatic stress disorder and that he was self-medicating with alcohol. And, you know, I think that's plausible. Teddy had a hard time talking about anything to do with his brother's death or with my cousin John's, which totally shattered his heart. I did succeed on one occasion in getting him to talk about the Warren Commission report, but it was an agonizing discussion. And he just had a visceral unwillingness. He would wince, his eyes would tear up, and he was, till the end of his life, he was profoundly and dramatically affected, almost as if it was day one, and he never got over that. Teddy, you know, was by nature, he was conservative, and that's ironic, but he was conservative, and he was a traditional, pious Catholic. He went to confession, he talked to his priest, he had a very strong relationship with an Irish priest named Father Jerry Creedon, and with a number of other priests with whom he felt comfortable talking about personal stuff. My generation grew up, I think, more comfortable talking about very intimate things in other settings. But Teddy, you know, Teddy really was a product of the old school. And also, there was an ethic in my family that we didn't have much right to complain about anything because we were so lucky in so many ways. We had wealth, we had education, we had wonderful friends, we had a supportive family. There were kids in Harlem and Watts and other parts of the country who lost their fathers to gun violence every day. And they didn't have the support system. They didn't have the resources that we did. My mother always told us, everybody takes their licks. And, you know, life is hard for everybody. And it's easier on balance for us than it is for most of the people on the planet. And, you know, that was, I think that was an important perspective, and it was a perspective that made it easy to stay grateful. And, you know, and there was also this thing against complaining. Any kind of complaining or self-pity was definitely discouraged in our family. My grandfather, Joseph Kennedy, would clap his hands and say, no whining in this house, no long faces. And I don't think that's that bad. There's kind of a peril to dwelling too much in the past. And I think the feeling was, you know, you can look, but don't stare. If you dwell too long in your injuries or your troubles or your tragedies, you can get stuck there. It's like swallowing poison in a way. You have to move forward. We all ultimately have to move forward, and we have to create our own lives, our own narratives. I don't think it was necessarily an unhealthy impulse not to dwell too much on those tragedies. My aunt Eunice, Eunice Shriver, she'd often tell us that she'd say there are too many important things going on right now to be worried about yourself. There's too many problems that can actually be solved. There's too many problems that you have the ability to be effective in solving. And my own experience was that I had a much greater comfort talking about the assassinations among some members of our generation and a lot with my children than my Uncle Teddy or my father's other siblings ever did during their lives.
The reports that supposedly there are members of your family who are upset with Patrick Kennedy for airing his problems that he's had over the years and, frankly, for also talking about his relationship with his dad and his attempts to intervene with his father's drinking, which he certainly says was a problem. And I know that there have been reports that there are members of your family that are upset about that. There's some question as to, will this mar in any way Ted Kennedy's legacy? What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think so. I don't think people in our family will be overly upset, or in any event, I don't think that they're going to stay upset for too long with Patrick. Everybody loves Patrick. All of us admire what he's doing. I certainly think that he's got tremendous courage, and I respect him for that. His experience with his father and his expectations from that relationship, I think, were different, maybe really very different than the rest of us. Patrick talks about an intervention that he participated in with Teddy where Teddy walked out. But, you know, many of us participated in interventions that year with Uncle Teddy. And more than a dozen of us from two generations were involved in various coordinated interventions that year. My own experience was a very good one with Teddy. I flew to Washington. I talked to him for a long time, over an hour in his office. And he responded very positively. And he was both grateful and gracious. In the end, I think it was a combination of all those interventions and his subsequent marriage to Vicky that really helped to change the way that he interacted with the world and the way that he used alcohol. He never stopped. You know, of course, everybody was urging total abstinence, and he never made it to that point. But he moderated his drinking so that after 1992, it was no longer causing serious problems in his life. I think everybody in my generation at various times had some anger at Teddy, but over time, I think we all forgave him. We especially knew that he'd been crushed by my father's death and by the death of his three older brothers. He was left raising 20 fatherless children, my 11 brothers and sisters, John Kennedy's two kids, Peter Lawford's four children, plus three of his own. And he never missed our birthdays. He attended all of our weddings. He was at every graduation. He returned to every phone call, usually within the hour. It was really extraordinary to me how hard he tried, how reliable he was as a surrogate father. I have literally hundreds of letters from my Uncle Teddy. when he traveled, he sent these funny postcards. He sent reminders on commemorative anniversaries for our family and for our country. He would write congratulatory notes whenever I published an op-ed in the New York Times or some other paper. He would take those publications and have them reprinted in the Congressional Record to show that he was proud of me. He wasn't just doing this for us, for me and my brothers and sisters and my cousins. He was doing it for our in-laws. And he was doing it for distant friends and for relatives and for literally hundreds of people across the state and across the country. He called or visited every Gold Star family in the state of Massachusetts, every family that lost a child in war. And he, of course, was a Gold Star child himself because his brother died in World War II. He called or he visited 140 Massachusetts families who lost loved ones in the World Trade Center attacks. And he wouldn't just make a call and that would be it. He would follow up oftentimes many, many times over the years. Every Tuesday, he quietly drove to inner city Washington, D.C. to read to public school children. Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker, told me that he met a little girl from Southeast Washington who never knew that for 3 years the senator who read, the man who read to her every Tuesday was a United States senator. So, and his staff didn't even know that he was doing that. At his, you know, when we had his funeral, 20,000 people appeared spontaneously at his wake. And I took my six children out to shake their hands, and we spent the evening out on that line, and they were immigrants for whom he'd gotten a green card. They were soldiers who he'd helped into the VA. They were senior citizens who he'd helped get their Social Security. I remember one man was the father of an illegal Costa Rican immigrant who had died fighting for the United States Marines in Iraq. And Teddy had arranged for his burial in Arlington. And then, you know, he did all that personal stuff. Then he was also doing his full-time job as senator. His fingerprints are on over 1,000 bills. He's probably the most productive senator in the history of the United States Senate. You know, all of the social issues that we care about, Sam, about Medicaid, Medicare, school lunch, you know, think about them, senior citizens, housing, education, American Indians, migrant workers, civil rights, voting rights, minimum wage, gay rights. He was the Senate leader on all of those, on health care and AIDS research, on religious freedom, you know, a million other things, immigration, arms control, gun control. He led the battles in the Senate against torture during the Bush administration, up against eavesdropping, against apartheid during Reagan's administration, and against Reagan's Central American wars, and against both wars in Iraq. You go down the issues, Sam, that you care about, and the principal legislation almost always was certainly drafted by Ted Kennedy. We knew what he was doing. And we also had a special consciousness of the burden that he was carrying around with him. And that, I think, made it easier for us to forgive him for some of his excesses for which he was famous, particularly in the two decades after my father's death, at a time when he was really suffering.
Lastly, Bobby, give us a sense of Patrick's legislation. How big of a deal do you think this is?
You know, I think that's exactly why most people in my family will end up really applauding Patrick. He's a serious person. He's smart. He knows what he's talking about. And this is a critical issue that no one else is championing. The media tends to highlight the gossipy aspects of the book and to ignore its much more serious purpose. And I think it's clear that he made these personal disclosures to advance an issue about which he's really passionate. And that's the issue of people of mental illness. And it's really the last frontier, Sam, for civil rights in this country. It's consistent with all the things that my family has done over the generations in terms of reaching out and forcing our American democracy to be more inclusive. My family was at the forefront of the civil rights movement during the 1960s and during the White House years. And then after Jack's assassination, Teddy's first bill was the Voting Rights Act of 1964, which he helped usher through the Senate in the wake of my Uncle Jack's death. My father became champion for migrant farm workers who were completely excluded from protection by the American labor laws since the 1930s. My father championed their plight and that of the American Indians and the people of Appalachia and the Mississippi Delta, all of these forgotten Americans who had been, you know, left behind by our political system. Kennedys and the Shrivers were the spear tip and the spear shaft in the civil rights movement for intellectually disabled people. My aunt Eunice created Special Olympics, and Anthony Shriver, her son, created Best Buddies. The JPK Foundation, which she ran, forced Americans to stop warehousing people with intellectual disabilities and to bring them into the mainstream. And, you know, we fought to bring them out of the darkness of shame and give them full citizenship. And that was probably, arguably, one of the most important civil rights movements in world history. So, you know, I think the last frontier of all those battles and the last barrier is for people who have mental illnesses. Under the law, people with mental illnesses generally are entitled to health insurance. They're entitled to treatment in hospitals, but the insurance companies systematically deny that, and they deny them coverage, believing that, you know, they'll be too ashamed and or too embarrassed or too fragile to stand up for themselves. And Patrick's effort is to say, we are coming out of the darkness. People who have these illnesses have a right to treatment. They are our brothers. They are our sisters. We need to take care of them as Americans. We can't advance our country by leaving our poor brothers and sisters behind or the vulnerable behind. And Patrick has stood up to say, I have this illness myself. He's giving other people the courage to do the same. And I think he needed to start that journey by telling his own story of mental illness. And I think it's noble and it's heroic. And, you know, I have nothing, Sam, but admiration for him.
Bobby Kennedy, really appreciate your time today.
Thanks.
There you have it. Interview we first ran on Ring of Fire, I think it was the past weekend, with Bobby Kennedy. And I don't know, fascinating stuff. I mean, I've told, you know, I've talked in the past about sort of how, you know, what a big deal it is for me as a kid who was... I mean, I actually served coffee to Bobby Kennedy in a restaurant I worked in 30 years ago. So to have the opportunity to talk to him on a regular basis on Ring of Fire, and he was in, I saw him in Las Vegas actually, and sat down with him. I actually, you know, we had a conversation, which I ended up recording, about vaccinations. I mean, Bobby has what I think, by all accounts, is a fairly controversial position on the safety of vaccinations. He reiterated this in our conversation. He is definitely in favor of vaccinations and has had his kids vaccinated. But he's got some questions about things like the vaccination board and whatnot, and about the use of thimerosal. We will get to that interview I don't know if I would call it even an interview, but that conversation in the near future. We've got to do a little bit of editing and clean it up a little bit for sound quality. But we will get to that. Also, in other news, should tell you, we're hoping to get Glenn Greenwald on in the next, hopefully in the next week or so, about the revelations that The Intercept printed, I guess it was at the end of last week, regarding our drone program. Like you didn't know, but apparently, you know, we bomb people, and, you know, you don't always know who your bombs are going to land on. And it's not just a question of who they're going to land on. You don't even know necessarily who you're targeting. And it's not always that you don't always know. It seems that, like, more often than not, you don't know who you're targeting. And you're just figuring. The one thing I think that must be the operating principle is that if we bomb people in Pakistan or Afghanistan from a drone, we know at the very least we're not even hitting Americans. And so we've got that going for us. Meanwhile, Afghanistan and Pakistan hit by a huge earthquake. It was a 7.5 earthquake on the Richter scale. That doesn't mean a lot to me. I mean, but put into context, that's a big earthquake. What is that? Is that my computer? That's, oh, God. You open up a single thing, the way that people do with their stupid autoplay things. There's a, the, it does sound loud around here. We're just, I'm not sure what it is. Is there any other microphone on? We're just doing playing around with the sound, ladies and gentlemen.
I think that's from the system update under the desk that we messed with, so we'll deal with it after.
Well, yeah,
the
we're going to deal with that sound a little bit. It's picking up a little bit on the gain. We've got a little bit extra gain on our voice today. all right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein you will hear a series of sound clips that we have prepared for you, ladies and gentlemen. Chris Christie reiterating what the head of the FBI said. Neither one of them have a shred of evidence to back it up, but it just feels right. Jeb Bush complaining that Americans don't appreciate what he's doing for the country just simply by running for president. Don't you realize how much you are all, and I'm looking at all three of you here in the office, how much you are benefiting from Jeb Bush being nice enough to run for president at the same time that you're alive and breathing?
I totally don't need to be doing this.
No, yeah, no. The, yeah. Jeb could be doing so many other things. Do you know how many boards? Do you take a guess at like how many corporate boards exist in the world?
In the fun half, I think we have a lot of theories about the various fun and cool things that Jeb could be doing.
There's so many things. Huh. We got a clip of Bernie Sanders at the Jefferson Jackson dinner. Donald Trump talks about his humble beginnings, reminiscent of Mitt Romney's struggling days as well. And Tony Blair basically apologizes for Iraq in many respects. And I think this is the same interview where he conceded that ISIS probably wouldn't exist if it were not for the Iraq invasion. Now, don't start sending Tony Blair thank you cards. It was a function of a report that came out that was, he was just getting out ahead of that, right?
Yeah, it's not out yet. He's getting, there's a, well, we'll talk about it in the fun half. I got it for you.
And, oh, folks, pre-peachment is here. That's right. I said pre-peachment. It is when you impeach someone before, from a position before they actually even have that position. Now, what is that noise now? Something just strange came on. Did I just hit something? All right, we got some sound issues. We will deal with that in a minute. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this.